Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode today is titled Displacement at the Heart of Polycrises. I am delighted to introduce our guest for today, Professor Balakrishnan Rajagopal, who is Associate Professor of Law and Development at the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he is also the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Adequate Housing. He founded the program on human rights and justice and the Displacement Research and Action Network at MIT. He is the author of International Law from Below, Development, Social Movements, and Third World Resistance by Cambridge University Press, which came out in 2003. And he is the co-editor of Reshaping Justice, International Law, and the Third World, which was published by Routledge in 2008, and Property Rights from Below, which he was a co-editor for Routledge in 2019, and finally, Critical Issues in Human Rights and Development, which was published by Edward Elgar in 2021. Welcome to the podcast, Raj.
Thank you, Romola, for having me.
So, I mean, you're a prolific author and you have, you know, done really remarkable work over the years. You're also now the UN Rapporteur on the Right to Adequate Housing. So I wanted to just start this conversation by talking about your background in international law and development and human rights and the work on displacement that you have done for several decades. So you started this Displacement Research and Action Network at MIT. So I just wanted to ask you, how did you come into this work and how has this influenced your current position as the UN Special Rapporteur?
Yeah, it's been a long journey. I mean, of course, I started off as a lawyer in terms of background. I was trained as a lawyer in India and came really to do my higher studies in law. But then during higher studies, I got bitten by the interdisciplinary bug and ventured well beyond law. And I was very privileged to be part of an emerging group of young scholars at the time who later became the critical third world approaches to international law. Because we're all asking the hard question after the end of the Cold War, what is the role of international law now if all history has ended, as Francis Fukuyama declared in the late 80s? And what is the role of a single hegemon, namely the United States as the unquestioned power? And how should North versus South conceptualize itself if all ideology has ended and all these big questions were before us? And I started really my career sort of being interested in international law for this reason. And I wanted to be part of an emerging, exciting moment in international law where a substantial number of new initiatives were being launched, including large peacekeeping operations in countries around the world. That was actually the first time in the UN history, in world history, that that was happening. And I was privileged to be part of the Cambodia mission, which was at that time the largest peacekeeping operation, doing human rights work in the field and legal work after the peacekeeping phase ended to assist the new government with rebuilding the legal system, which had been shattered during the Khmer Rouge years in the 1970s and not rebuilt during the years after that. So that's how I got into human rights work as an engaged scholar and practitioner. But then I decided to come back to do my doctoral work at Harvard Law School and really sort of began to look at the nexus between human rights and development. And the main motivation for that was because in the intervening years, I had been really following and being taken up by large social movement struggles because of destructive development projects, especially in the country of my origin, India. The specific project that influenced me hugely was the Narmada Dam project, which was a project that influenced a lot of us, I think, in the 90s. I began to closely follow it. I did field work. I interacted a lot with people who were involved in it, and many hard questions emerged for me. And therefore, my doctoral work was really on development, to understand this thing called development. What is development? How do we understand it? So my doctoral committee was formulated with that in mind, with, among others, Amartya Sen on the committee. So the idea was to understand development at a very deep level and to develop a critical understanding of development, especially from a human rights perspective, and not to be hesitant to critique human rights as well, in case it turns out to be an accomplice in legitimizing development practices. So that was actually an amazing moment. And as I said, I had a great cohort of young scholars with me in the 90s. And that's how I got into the whole work on development and human rights as an international lawyer, and then took it along to sort of a more serious academic career.
That's a really fascinating history. And you've done so many really interesting bits of work in different places, and it's so global in scope. So I wanted to just ask you then to reflect on talking about the structural drivers of displacement in your view. And given your very interdisciplinary background, I wanted to ask you, in your view, what you think the differences and assumptions are in the different fields that study displacement.
My work with the Narmada Dam Project actually got me into work with the World Commission on Dams, which was set up by the IUCN and the World Bank and several other social movements who had been, including the Narmada Bachao Andolan, who had been leading the struggle against the dam. And but the World Commission on Dams was the first global multi-stakeholder effort to assess the performance of dams. How well they do? Do they do? Do they? How do they do on the environmental front? How do they do in terms of protection of human rights? How do they do in terms of, in fact, fulfilling their own project goals? For example, do they produce as much electricity or prevent as much flooding as they claim that they would? And how do they play out financially? So we looked at all dimensions. It was a huge multi-year effort. And I was human rights advisor for the World Commission in the 90s. And the World Commission's work showed unambiguously that unfortunately, large development projects, and as well as all development for that matter, whether it's urban or rural, whether it's infrastructure based, or is it policy based, or it's driven by so-called aesthetic consideration, including beautification and all the rest of it, or preserving historical heritage property, whatever the reason for development is, because ultimately heritage preservation depends on, for example, the expected return in terms of tourism. So if you actually look at all development activity, it turns out that people who are in the way are treated as though they have no rights. They just are seen as just floating around, disposable people whose main sort of the main approach taken towards these people is that they are displaceable. They can be simply pushed from one place to another, like pawns on a chessboard. And all you have to do is simply think about, in the best case scenario, the appropriate compensation framework for them. No other dimensions come into play. Now, the fact that some losses could be uncompensable, or that the losses may go beyond monetary loss to emotional, psychological, or cultural losses, was not really part of the conversation. And I looked at the practice of multilateral development banks, like the World Bank, for example, who did have frameworks for compensating people who are displaced by large projects, like dam projects. And the euphemistic term that the bank used and still uses is involuntary displacement or involuntary resettlement. Not displacement, but involuntary resettlement. So you would not know that people are actually being violently displaced due to this involuntary. And involuntary, by the way, means forced. That's basically what it means. But Why call it force when you can be more diplomatic and call it involuntary, right? So that's still what it is. And so to me, what was becoming obvious was that development as an enterprise essentially relies on displaceability, being able to move people around. And if you think about the history of capitalism itself, which ultimately is what development is about transition from a pre-modern way of organizing the economy to organizing societies to a more modern and therefore more efficient sort of transition. The whole of Industrial Revolution was based on that, right? So urbanization and development, they both depend crucially on cutting people off from their connection with the land. If people are too attached to the land, they will keep going back to it. But the main sort of way to make them freely available labor, or what the economist Arthur Lewis called in the 50s as unlimited supply of labor in his theories about economic development, he's considered to be the founding father of development economics. But if you look at this concept of unlimited supply of labor, obviously what Arthur Lewis means is not that there is an infinite number of people. Obviously, people are limited in terms of labor. What he means is an unavailable supply of labor at cost that actually still makes sense to rely on and employ. So the idea of surplus labor comes really from a given number of labor inputs that would be necessary for achieving a given economic output. And if there is more labor available for achieving the output than what is necessary, then that is the ideal situation for achieving, say, positive economic growth trajectories. So economic growth projections, therefore, even today, you look at economic growth projections, they are all higher in countries with younger populations, with surplus labor, where the unemployment rate is actually higher, like India, for example. But they tend to be much lower as the population becomes older, like Japan, or the population actually is fully employed, then, economic growth becomes slower. Because the whole concept of economic growth and development depend on this availability of surplus labor. So to me, therefore, if you look at this displaceability issue, you can look at it through multiple disciplines. You can look at it through economic theory and economic development, as I said, for all the reasons that I mentioned just now. You can look at it through urbanization, which is dependent on the, for example, say the idea of urban economic clusters. It's a crucial concept in urban development. Or you can look at it through anthropology, applied anthropology, which is in fact the only discipline that looked at the whole displaced population's experience, not through the perspective of those who want to derive benefits from displacement, but from the perspective of those who are displaced themselves. So these were studies done in the 50s and 60s by looking at large, in fact, hydro projects in countries like Zambia to look at how, the displacees experience panned out. And the answer was terrible. They were terribly, off because of displacement. And their subsequent generations didn't recover either. Their children, their grandchildren. So it's a multi-generational blow from which displaced populations don't recover easily. And then you can also look at displacement also through, of course, human rights, which is a framework which has become more and more influential, I would say, since the late 70s and gradually picking up momentum from the 90s. So it's a very recent framework, but that provides another critical way to sort of look at displacement. So there are many ways in which we can actually approach displacement and try to understand it. So I teach a course on displacement, taught it for, well, like 13 years now, probably at MIT. And at that time, I believe still is the case that certainly in the United States, there aren't any planning schools that teach courses on displacement. Mine was the first. And the course syllabus is literally, it draws on all of these literatures that I just mentioned. And one has to have the openness of mind to look at all of them and how they come together. That's all.
There's sort of a synergy between conflict and development as well, that a lot of what we see in terms of violence of development also translates into conflicts in different kinds of ways. But I wanted to just, again, ask you because you've written so much about this and you talk about this quite a bit in your work as a special rapporteur on that question of armed conflict as well as a driver of displacement. So I just wanted to ask you to talk to us about that as well and, how that acts as a driver of displacement across borders and whether this too is a structural issue and how we should approach this.
Absolutely. Of course, displacement is a very large phenomenon and is driven by a number of factors, including the industrialization, land speculation, commodification of land, the consolidation of state authority and power over land, elimination of multiple tenure systems, for example, and the assertion of state sovereignty over all land, which is all, by the way, of much more recent vintage than what people understand. But on the other hand, we have also seen displacement caused and driven by large-scale phenomena, including conflict and increasingly disasters that are related to climate change impacts, large-scale flooding, landslides, those kinds of things. If you look at data on internal displacement, for example, first of all, there are two kinds of displacements when we talk about the word displacement. One is displacement within the border of a country in which people live. The other is displacement across an international border when they end up in another country. Once people cross a border, the same displaced people are called refugees. Or if they're fleeing because of fear, then they can be asylum seekers. But the word refugee can be broader than that. But in fact, although media focuses so much on refugee flows, this is particularly true in Europe, where far-right parties have made a big deal about migrant flows, especially after the Syrian war and Afghani flows. And I was able to see that when I visited Netherlands as a UN rapporteur, for example. The far-right party won the election literally by riding that particular, using that one particular factor. But on the other hand, if you look at the numbers, it simply doesn't add up. The refugees are minuscule in number, really. And the largest flows of people are within borders. They are not across borders. And within borders, though, it is very worrying that right now the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center estimates that there are about 83 million people who are internally displaced, of which, more than 70 million are actually displaced by conflict, and the rest by disasters. About 10, 11 million by disasters. So conflict remains a major, major driver of displacement. When conflict happens, people are forced to flee or their homes are destroyed, they usually end up moving a few miles or essentially moving far enough away, but without necessarily intending to leave their country. That is true even in the largest conflicts that we are seeing today, like, for example, Sudan. There are over 7 million people within Sudan, but 3 million have fled across the border. But 7 million are still within the country. And that is true of Myanmar, and that is certainly true of Gaza. Of course, there the situation is different because they are trapped within the territory. They cannot leave because of the complete blockade of the territory. But the reality is this, that most people affected by conflict and get displaced end up within their country. So the question of what rights internally displaced people have is at the heart of all displacement research that aims to improve things. I started looking at conflict more and more systematically, first structurally, because as you said, there is a relationship between conflict and development. Development, especially when it is done in a way that generates, shall we say, unequal burden and benefit sharing, produces tension and rises to the potential of conflict. That conflict can be more low-key, disagreements, more peaceful ways of expressing dissent, etc. But it can escalate if the response to the conflict is actually a harsh, heavy-handed approach by the state or other authorities. People start dying, then organized opposition, rebellions can begin to happen to contest land dispossession. And we've seen that repeatedly over history. Violent movements have emerged, including, around the question of rural land dispossession in particular. So conflict and development are always, of course, very much connected. But what we are also seeing increasingly is that the world has become more and more urbanized. More and more people live in urban areas. So when warfare happens between countries, countries attack each other. In fact, it's the urban centers where most people live are the ones that get attacked. That's where the military infrastructure is, including communication infrastructure. And unfortunately, those attacks end up causing very large urban damage and very large displacement. We see that literally in the case of Ukraine right now. We see it in the case of Gaza. 77% of Gaza's population was urban before October 7th, 2023. So when Gaza was attacked by Israel, of course, all damage has unfortunately been urban, and all buildings have therefore been destroyed, and people have become homeless as a result. So the impact of conflict on displacement, or conflict as a driver of displacement, is huge. It's massive. And that's the reason I submitted a report in 2022 to the UN General Assembly in my capacity as a rapporteur on conflict and the right to adequate housing. Housing or home, to put it more personally, home is more, because the word housing, conveys in kind of a impersonal mechanistic sense of something that is delivered by planners. But home is different. When we talk about our home, we don't call it housing. We call it home. But for whatever reason, that's basically the framework that we use to talk about housing. But homes are destroyed in vast numbers. And the impact of this destruction is something I wanted to capture really in housing rights terms. So the goal of that report was to, number one, highlight the scale and the intensity of home destruction in and the resulting displacement and homelessness that happens, and to advocate for curbing that and to deter the military practices that indiscriminately destroy these areas. And so what I proposed concretely was to treat all mass destruction of housing as a crime under international law for which people can be prosecuted. And I called it domicide. Now, that's a term that is not new to scholars of architecture in particular, but I was the first to use it in the context of housing and particularly in terms of human rights and humanitarian and international law, advocating for recognition of domicide as a crime, just like genocide is a crime that we prosecuted. And I laid out the ways in which it can be done. And that's really had a major, major impact, including on not just on state practice and countries mobilizing around it, but also among architects and among designers. I see quite a lot of take. There is an ongoing exhibit, a year-long exhibit on domicide at the Smithsonian Design Museum in New York City, for example, that was in fact inspired by a New York Times op-ed that I had published on domicide. And they came to me, consulted with me, and they set up this exhibit. And many, many other ways in which domicide is being seriously looked at, that this is just not okay in an urban planet. If we engage in indiscriminate warfare to settle all of our disputes, we end up destroying the urban settlements, and that's going to be immeasurably damaging, primarily starting with the loss of home. Loss of home is incredibly important, and we need to take it more seriously. That's the kind of work that I've tried to do.
I mean, that actually led me to the next question, which was to ask you about, your work as the special rapporteur and looking at the right to adequate housing and how that comes into this discussion of displacement. And I just wanted to ask, I mean, you talked about domicide, and I just, for the audience who may not be familiar with the term or understand the implications of what it means to lose a home or lose a house, that it's not just the loss of that physical structure, that it goes beyond that. So I just wanted to ask you to just elaborate a little bit on what the sort of ramifications are of losing one's home, that beyond that physical space and, that physical structure itself.
Absolutely. I mean, from a human rights perspective, a home is not just four walls and a roof. A home is much more than that. It's actually what enables the exercise of many of your rights, starting with your right to exist as a family or as safely as an individual, to be secure in your person and body, to be able to enjoy autonomy and privacy, to be able to function as a member of your close unit, which is your family, but also from your house as a member of other a larger community, your neighbors, your street, your city, and so on and so forth. We are part of concentric rings of so many communities, but it's a home that anchors us into all of that. And ultimately, home is also a repository of your memories. Whatever you experience, all the good and bad moments that are worth remembering, all happen, so often at home. The birth of your child, or the passing away of elder, or father, mother, or important cultural events that you may host, like a function in your house, whatever. They all happen at home very often. And it's very important to take home more seriously. And of course, home is also functionally related to access to other rights, including crucially education. Where you live determines which school your kids go to, as we all know. And we all, in fact, choose where to rent or buy a house based on what schools are nearby. That's one of the first questions we ask if we aim to have a family. And then we ask about hospitals. Where would I, like, is there a decent healthcare? So it's connected to health as well. It's connected to your job, because you wonder how long it'll take for you to commute to work. And so transportation is very important. Is there public transportation? Do I have to drive? Will I depend on some other form of transport? So all rights, ultimately, your right to earn a living, for example, which depends crucially on your labor rights, including your right to a job, ultimately depend on your housing and your location. So all these elements are in fact part of what is called as right to adequate housing. It's not just four walls and a roof, but it consists of various elements. You have to have security of tenure. You have to have the right to have to live in a location that makes sense, given all your other rights. Your house should be affordable, should not be so out of reach, or you shouldn't be paying disproportionate amount of your earnings for it. It should be something that is habitable. So all of these elements are crucial part of the definition, legal definition of the right to adequate housing. And that's how we have actually approached it in terms of housing. Now, the way we understand housing in this human rights way, in fact, I would say is not the mainstream way of understanding housing in many disciplines that say that they study housing. But they don't really. They really don't understand housing. And among that, I would chiefly blame urban planning. Urban planning, unfortunately, has drifted out to treat housing, more and more as a noun, as John Turner said, in the 70s. John Turner, the well-known, well, I don't have to introduce people who are in urban studies about who John Turner was, but he wrote a very interesting piece in the 70s asking if housing is a noun or a verb. It's a profound question, and the way you answer it gets to the question that I'm trying to raise, whether housing is more than four walls and a roof, or simply a stuff thing that people in power do for those without power. So if you look at housing as something that is provided by those in power to those who are out of power, then it can be seen as simply a material good that is just built and aims to make, quote unquote, those people's lives better. But if you look at housing in a different way, which is as the root of much of what it means to be human, essentially, then you come at it from a very different perspective. The urban dimension is at the heart of displacement, in fact. As for all the reasons we've discussed, and urban and displacement is at the heart of all urban questions and is at the heart of all development questions. So clearly, all these fields should be engaging and talking with each other much more.
Now, that's a very fair point, and that's a really important observation as well, that we get very easily siloed into our disciplines, and actually it would be really helpful for us to step outside of it and think more critically and engage with these questions also from a global perspective. I wanted to close with a question I mean, looking around, we many of us kind of feel like, oh, these are dark days of war and violence and increasing displacement. We see the stats on displacement as well globally. We're seeing evictions, we're seeing deportations and clashes over that, and it's all been very traumatizing for a lot of people for a range of different reasons. And I feel like we really do want to think about A, what can be done, and B, what is being done. And so I wanted to ask you, again, in your position as someone who's a special rapporteur who has this global perspective, who's going to different countries and seeing what's happening, who's writing these reports, and sees all these different processes happening in tandem with each other. What do you think are some of the hopeful signs, whether it's in law or policy or in pedagogy or in even in academic work, to sort of push back against some of these processes of displacement or counter some of its impacts?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the way we look at whether the moment we find ourselves in gives us hope or not depends on the perspective you have. If your perspective is very short term or focused entirely on the current moment, separate from what has happened in the past or what may be coming, then it can lead to some pessimistic conclusions. Because as you said, all you see is stories of displacement due to affordable housing crisis. It's the biggest issue in election after election, especially in rich countries. And elections are won or lost on the housing issue. We have seen that in Netherlands. We've seen that in UK. We've seen that now playing out in New York City. The number one issue before the New York City mayor election is affordability. So this also coincides with large numbers, very large historic numbers of people displaced by conflict, and a alarmingly sharp rise in the number of people displaced because of climate change impacts, because of disasters, but also because of climate change justified so-called green policies that end up displacing people in order to quote unquote preserve carbon mass. So in fact, there's quite a lot of green grabbing of land from indigenous people and others, all on the theory that their use of forest resources, for example, is actually damaging to the rights of future generations. And therefore, they need to be evicted from where they are. And I deal quite a lot with these cases as a special rapporteur, actually. And these people end up complaining to my office and in many countries. So, therefore, what I would say is that if we look take a bit of a longer term perspective, then we have seen that in fact there is quite a lot of positive sort of developments we can notice in terms of legal and policy changes that have tried to, first of all, recognize that displacement is undesirable. It leaves people worse off, period. There is no upside to displacement, or there is no way to recover from displacement by simply coming up with the so-called right policy response. There is no such magic response, in fact. But we can mitigate many, many negative effects as much as possible. And there have been efforts. And one of those efforts is the coming up with the global standards. Because you need global sort of benchmarks against which countries should be able to ask, are we measuring up to that, or what is the standard by which countries know if they're doing better or not? So some of those standards have been very influential, like the 1998 Guiding Principles on Internal Displacement by the UN, the 2007 Basic Principles and Guidelines on Development-Based Evictions and Displacement that was issued by my predecessor, first Special Rapporteur on Right to Adequate Housing. And then we have legally binding treaties like the Kampala Convention and the Great Lakes Protocol in Africa that have, for the first time, recognized displacement as a harm legally and legally mandate states to reduce it or to avoid it. That's a very important step. None of the other regions have such a treaty. So I see the African lead as very important on that. Then there are policy changes, including multilateral development banks like the World Bank, which for the first time developed an internal policy that is binding on its staff in 1982, in fact, Operational Directive 4.12, which was about ensuring basic fair treatment of people who may be facing quote unquote involuntary resettlement, the euphemistic term that they use for displacement, as I said. But that standard has been further improved. In fact, the current standard, which has drawn from the 1982 standard, is ESF5, Environmental Social Safeguard Number 5, which is actually quite excellent. Although not followed as much in practice, but the bench line has been fixed. So now the question is a little bit easier because instead of asking for improvement of standards, the question now becomes why aren't countries and World Bank itself complying more with their own standards when they're funding projects, for example, right? So I see positive developments in policy terms. I see positive developments in legal terms. I see many, many court cases where judges are applying these global standards. We don't have enough time to get into those cases, but there are many, many such cases around the world. And then we have, crucially, I would say, beyond law and policy, I also see increasing recognition of displacement as a topic of scholarly investigation and also of pedagogical focus. As I said, my course was the first at MIT or in the region or anywhere, as far as I know, in a planning school on displacement. But that inspired another course taught by a professor at Harvard School of Design and then has led to other courses elsewhere as well. There are people who are teaching more systematically about displacement, and that's a good sign. And as I said, architects have been very, very proactive in recent years, particularly in the context of the discussion around domicile, to recognize destruction of homes and displacement as key concerns for architectural societies. The German League of Architects, in fact, has adopted domicile as an official platform for them. And I see quite a lot of interest in studying it among and focusing on it among other scholars. And from my own side, in fact, I am developing the first global guiding principles on resettlement, which I will submit to the UN Human Rights Council next March. And this, I hope, will be also used as a global benchmark by countries and courts and advocates around the world to sort of push for treatment of people who, unfortunately, despite best efforts, have been displaced, but they need to end up in a better way. And the way to do that is hopefully by following some of these guidelines. So those are positive things that I do see on how the world is responding to displacement as a crisis.
Wow, this was such a rich and inspiring conversation, Raj. Thank you. You've given us so much to think about, and I feel like this has been like this incredible and expansive conversation that sort of, went from development to human rights to kind of looking at urban studies and planning and so forth, and looking at all the different kinds of issues around the world. And your work in so many different places has been really interesting and rich, and has really inspired, so much thought around these questions of displacement. I'm glad that you think and you've told us of all the progress that's being made amongst the different organizations to counter the negative impacts of displacement and so forth. I mean, I know that given your background and everything that you've been talking about today, we could talk for hours. But I really appreciate the time that you've given us and all the stories that you've shared. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.